Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So just get back to now. So good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for your kind attendance and devoting this time to hear more about Syria. This country is in deep trouble. My name is Mohammed Mamalat. I'm originally from Syria. I've been in the UK for more than 16 years. And I'm proud to be Syrian and British as well. And I'm just going to highlight a few things which you might not know about Syria. So the reason why I'm here, I'm Syrian, I'm British, I'm proud to be both. I'm impartial in my presentation because, I mean, a lot of people might say, the reason why I put this slide, you might be presenting one side. I'm presenting the humanitarian side. I'm presenting the children, the innocent people of Syria who are suffering. My family, my parents are still in Aleppo, which is in the news. They are refusing to leave. And we have been going through the suffer for the last 5 years. Personally, in 2010, I finished my training. I became a consultant for 2-3 years, and I decided to go back to join my family. A few months after we moved to Syria, everything started to kick on, and I came back for a short period of sort of a local morgue, and I've been stuck here since 2011. I haven't seen my parents for about 5-6 years. So I'm very concerned. The other thing, we are trying all to help here, and we have been, personally, I have been involved with the crisis and trying to help people as a doctor, as a human being. And the objects of this talk, to highlight the situation, as a person involved, the media and the political opinions are not reflecting the reality on the ground. Everyone is working according to his agenda and his main interests. But the civilians are the true victims in the middle of this. You might find me sort of mourning a little bit. I'm not expecting a solution. I know it's very, very complex. But at least if we can raise the awareness about the difficulty and the true situation in Syria, that might help all the parties in the future. So to go through the whole thing going in Syria, I think it's very important that we have a bit of background about what has been happening in the country, at least in the last 40, 50 years, because it's quite relevant to what's happening in the meantime. And then we'll try to sort of reflect and see if there's anything we can offer to help. So this is my city. This is Aleppo. This is the castle in the center of Aleppo. Aleppo is a city which is about 4,000 or 5,000 years old. There's life history, which, I mean, this is a view which you can walk around. All the official buildings are just around here, the old market. And I'll show you how some of these interesting places have been affected and destroyed during the war in my presentation. This is a night view of the river and the quayside on the river. And this is the map of Syria. So for people who don't know where Syria is, so Syria is in the sort of east end of the Mediterranean Sea. So there's long border with Turkey in the north, and then we've got Iraq on the east, and this is Jordan south, and we've got Lebanon, and a border with Palestine, Israel. So the capital, Damascus, is in the south. The second major city in Syria is Aleppo in the north. The other areas which are coming on the news, Raqqa, Deir ez-Zor, are all this side of Syria. This part of Syria is mainly sort of desert, so there isn't a lot of population in that part. And then we have got the Mediterranean Sea cities. We've got Latakia, the main one, and then the other cities which you might have heard about, Homs and Hama. Population of Syria is about 25 million people. The country is 189,000 square meters. And as you can see, I mean, with the conflict, I mean, these are old figures. It's showing how people started to flee the country in different directions. These figures have changed a lot since I did this presentation before. why is it happening? I mean, I thought a lot, I mean, how can I present that? And I thought, I mean, I lived in the country for about 28 years. I was born in Germany to a father who's a surgeon who did 20 years of training and studying in Europe, and then he decided to go to the country when I became sort of school age. So I returned to Syria at the age of 7. That was around 1977, 1978. And as you remember, President Assad, the father, came to power about 1969. Around that period, 1978, he came with a decision to make the Ba'ath Party the only and the controlling party in Syria, and there was a great unrest in the country, which started 1979, and exactly to what happened now, the government tried to control the unrest in a very, very harsh way. Hundreds of thousands of people arrested, disappeared. And when you say arrested in Syria, the people, what you don't know, that means you disappear. It's not like here. I mean, you'll be told you are arrested for this reason. You can't have a solicitor. Your family know where you are. They can get in contact with you. What it means, you suddenly disappear. And the family or the relatives will have no clue where the person has gone. He might be dead, he might be alive, there's no communication, nothing can be done about it. Things continued up to 1981, because so many people were killed and arrested. Assad decided, I mean, to control the whole situation. He ordered the special forces in Syria, led by his brother Rifat al-Assad, and they decided to punish one city in Syria so they can control the uprising, what happened at that. And the decision was between Aleppo and Hama, and then finally they decided they are going to attack Hama. The orders were to destroy the whole country. So the whole city was surrounded for 15 days, airstrike, artillery, you name it. And these are the pictures from 1981, February. No accurate figures, but I mean, the estimates, the minimum is 15,000 killed. Some estimates go to 45,000. I remember as a child, 5 years following that, when we used to travel to Damascus from Aleppo, the city was under siege by the security forces. Nobody was allowed to go to Hama. They destroyed all these buildings. They flattened them with the ground, so nobody can witness what happened in the city. This is the Grand Mosque in Hama. This is the pictures after the attack. And this is the appearance of the city following that. So the reason why I'm coming to that, I'm not sure how many people between the audience are aware of the massacre of Hama. Al-Assad, the father, managed to control the country for another 30 years following that. What I remember in my childhood as a student in the primary school is tanks, soldiers, barriers between the streets. At the house where we used to live, the next door flat used to be owned to one of the officers, and it was let to a Russian officer, and we used to have two soldiers on the door with their sort of whole kit, you know. And every time we wanted to go to our house, we have to ask them to move so we can get through the door. So that lasted up to the sort of mid-80s. Following this, Syria, the rich country, you know, we had 10 years where you have to queue hours to get your bread, queue hours to get some sugar, to get some rice, to get some fruits. That continued up to the 1990s. You are just on queues and queues and queues. Following that, everything changed. Mobile phones came, satellite came, internet became available, and they couldn't control the country this way. What happened over the years, the people in power realized, I mean, from being officers in the army controlling the country, you can now become sort of businessmen. So they tried to have shares in every single business in Syria. What is happening now? The amount of corruption and control in the country became unbelievable. And if you go 4 or 5 years back, with the, what was called the Arabic Spring. The whole situation was similar in most of the Arabic countries, talking about Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, similar conditions. The oppression was intolerable. People have been suffering. Corruption was invading everything. Everyone thought there's no future if we continue like that. So Syria was one of the countries which thought, I mean, with all this atmosphere going, with all what's happening, this is the time to move. And we thought, I mean, everything will be on the media, we'll have the international support, and things will be fine. But then the current president, he's a president, but he's the son of the previous president. You know, it took 5 minutes when Al-Assad, the father, died to change the constitution, lower the age of the president of the republic from 40 to 35. You have a monkey parliament MPs who voted for that, and he suddenly became president. But everyone thought, this man is coming from the West. He had training in Britain. He's married to a second-generation Syrian from Britain. He will have a different mentality. Hopefully this is a new start. And all the Syrians, I mean, in open heart, believed in that. But then when the moment of truth came, he decided to use the same way like his father did. I'm going to show you a clip maybe to sum the last 5 years, the events. I apologize, I mean, some of the pictures might be quite distressing, and if anyone is feeling that, I mean, they are too much for him, I will just skip them. But I'm just trying to show you what the media is not showing in the meantime. Apologies for the distressful images.
أطفال ونساء في الغوطة الشرقية نتيجة قصف
العدو. The pictures have shocked the world. Hundreds of people killed in an apparent chemical weapons attack on a Damascus suburb. What is perhaps equally shocking is that Western diplomats had hoped that once on the ground, the UNT would be able to broaden the scope of their inspections.
How are you? How are you? This guy.
أدي صلحت معك له؟
تقلي شو جاي عبارة انت؟ شو جاي عبارة؟ جاي عبارة خلاص؟ قد ايش صلاك معك كتير؟ طيب جوعان هلا انت؟ شو عم تاكل؟ قلي شو عم تاكل؟
أفهم ليش عم بضربني؟ يعني معك من الأوعاد ضعيف؟ بس هيك؟
My apologies again, I mean, for the shocking pictures. But I mean, this is to some firefighters. The pictures at the beginning, this is the chemical attack near Damascus, you know. This is 2 kilometers away from the UN offices. And the international community is still questioning who executed that, and they are still questioning whether the targets are civilians. 1,300 people killed within a couple of hours. So, let me get back to the... So, talking about the historical places, this is the Grand Mosque in Aleppo. It's very close to the castle, 1,500 years old. This is the picture now. As you can see, the minaret has gone. That has been targeted in the first year of the conflict in Syria. It has been burned and dropped. And this is how half of the city is looking in the meantime. And this is the siege. These are the pictures from Madaya, which has been on the news recently. Starvation to death. Yesterday on the news, there was a 5-year-old boy who died as well from starvation. Another picture. So this is when everything came to the public, when they found the body of this little child on the coast area in Turkey. And this is when the international community started to hear about the refugee crisis in Syria. And these are some of the statistics about the, why these people are fleeing the country in the meantime. Have a look on this. How can we help? I mean, So these people are not migrants. They are not just leaving the country looking for a better life. They are looking just for life. Life became hell. I mean, we have lost maybe a couple of generations with this war now. Kids have not been going for any regular education for 5 years now. The health system in the country has completely collapsed. The basics are not available. I mean, I'm telling you, my parents are in Aleppo now. This is 71 days with no running water. They didn't have any electricity for 6 months. So they are buying water which is brought from the river or from whatever. Unbelievable prices. Electricity, they have 5 hours a day. It's a business now. People buy a generator and they sell a bit of electricity for the flats in the nearby area, given that they can manage to get some fuel to run the generators. So you are extremely lucky if you have 5 hours, so you can keep some food in the fridge if you can find any food. So so many doctors, I've lost so many colleagues. Doctors and hospitals are the ultimate target for the regime, for the airstrikes, basically. What we are talking about, I mean, 90% of all the destruction which you see, if you notice, I mean, there are airstrikes. The regime, in the meantime, controls less than 20% of the country. And they haven't got any manpower to fight for them. So the only force which they are using is the air force. And now to make things better, we've got the Russians. So that's more vigorous. And if I go back to the map maybe of Syria, as we know, or maybe you don't know, I'll show you on the map. The ISIS groups, as believed, should be controlling this area of Syria. So the eastern part, this is Raqqa, and going up to here. All the airstrikes, the international statistics, are happening in this area, 99% of them, and targeting civilian areas. So the victims are civilians. So how can we help? I mean, it's a big crisis. This will need international community efforts, you know. The figures are showing now, inside Syria, there's 8 million people displaced. The last 2 weeks, the intense airstrikes on Aleppo, you've got 200,000 people waiting on the border with Turkey. These are people who had houses and shelters just a couple of weeks ago. Now they are homeless. So I'll show you my personal experience. It's a very, very complex issue. In 2012, it was my first visit to the country. So it was planned that there's a new field hospital opening in the border between Syria and Turkey. So on our first day, we went to visit one of the refugee camps. This is called Atma refugee camp. And as you can see, the towers are just the Turkish border. You see this? This is the Turkish border. So we are just inside Syria. So we are on the borderline. This is the refugee camp. Just to get you an idea what a refugee camp means. So this is the health, this is the medical point in the camp. It's just a porta cabin. This is the facility which you have inside. This camp, when I went there, there was 30,000 people. 60% of them are children, as you will see. This is the shop of the camp, and this is how people are living. I mean, we went there for 3 hours. We came with mud up to here. The temperature was -1 when we went there. Look what they are wearing. I mean, half of them didn't have. This is the school of the camp. It's a tent. And this is the hospital which we went to. This is the border control area. And I'll just go one picture, which we tried to convert to hospital. So the mountains are the Turkish border. We've got a generator because there's no electricity. And we just tried to convert this building to a hospital. So this is the borderline. So we have been working with the OSIM, which is the Union of the Charities for Syria. We had a lot of donations, you know, secondhand equipment and stuff. We had a warehouse about 50 meters by 50 meters full of things which nobody had a clue what they are. So we started finishing the building, assembling the machines. It wasn't functioning at that stage. We have been working on generator because there's no electricity, no running water. We tried to get the small intensive care area, operating theaters. We are just trying to get things ready. This is all donations. This is donations coming from the UK through Syria Relief, you know, same ambulance. These are used ambulance which has been purchased. We filled them with equipment, whatever we can do. And you can see this is in the middle of the night. We are just downloading them to the hospital. And these are the charities who are contributing to that. This is the emergency room. I'll show you when we started working. This is a chap who passed while you have been testing the machines, and he said, I mean, I felt something going into my chest. And I'll show you, we just x-rayed him. And you can see a bullet this size just in front of his chest bone on the screen. So these are some of my colleagues. Most of them are from here, from the UK. And after a week, we managed to do the first operation. This is me doing the first operation in that hospital. This is our team, which we managed to assemble. And we started receiving the casualties from the surrounding areas. Mainly civilian casualties. So this is a chap who had a bullet. I'll show you the pictures, just going through his jaw from one side to the other. And this is the entry and the exit wounds. He's lucky, I mean, he survived that. This is a 7-year-old girl, just coming back from school, shrapnel going to the brain. She's in coma. She died later on. This is a family who came in the middle of the night as we are finishing our shift. Family going to bed, a tank decided to target their house. Few members of the family killed, and few of them, they had to travel 60 miles to reach us. So there's no other hospitals. There's no transfusion service, so when you have anyone bleeding, you have live volunteers just lying down. And this is how our emergency room look when you have the casualties coming. You're talking about 10, 20, 30 people coming together. All of them have got major injuries. Again, I mean, this is the same family, shrapnels in the brain. And I will stop here because, I mean, the pictures are quite distressful. So this is what we are talking about. I'll leave it at here. I mean, it's a huge subject, very difficult to cover, you know. But, I mean, I'm quite happy to take any questions from the floor. Or, I mean, do you want Zainab to go ahead and then we can have, I'll leave it to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
everyone.
We thought, with your permission, we'd have both speakers and then open for questions. I hope that's all right. So, thank you so much, Dr. Rangnath. Really kind.
Just trying to get through.
The next bit, it's a measure of just how foolish I am. That when we first started thinking about this and planning this, I thought, wouldn't it be a nice idea to have some refugees along to hear about their story and how they got here, what life was like and why they left their country. So I contacted the British Red Cross. We're going to hear what they do. And kind Zainab, who's here to talk to us, was so patient and so lovely. And without saying, listen, you idiot, she just managed to convey to me that these people arrived in December 2015, and I'm expecting them to come to a bunch of English people, when they barely speak the language, they're traumatized by what they've been through, and they're going to talk to us about their experience. I mean, really, you know. But it's a measure of just how little we know and how much we have to do to learn to sympathize and understand what these poor people are going through, that I could be so stupid. Anyway, fortunately for us, Zainab is not that stupid, and she does a lot of work with the refugees, and she's the boss lady of the whole of the Thames Valley for British Red Cross and Humanitarian Action. And we're delighted to have you with us, and thank you so much for coming.
Did you want the pointer? Do you want the mic? Isn't it? Yes.
You promise we'll share.
I promise to share, yeah.
This. Okay. Looks very official, feels very official. Thank you very much, Romy. I don't know what to say or where to start with your introduction, but thank you very much. And I think I feel really privileged to have this opportunity to be able to talk to the group here today and be part of your Lenten group talks. Before I start, thank you, Dr. Mamlat, for sharing that with us, because I think the perspective we get is what's on our doorstep and how to support people when they get here, but not always do we get to know a lot of the background. I think we read about it, we see it on telly. And as Romy said, sometimes really difficult for people to be able to share their stories. Sometimes they get there, but it's really, really a challenge. Just want to share something with you before I actually get into what the Red Cross does. Last weekend, I was at a circuit gathering in Reading. Both my husband and I are part of the Methodist circuit. And it was about looking to see what we, you know, as members of the church, or just generally anybody, looking to see who are pioneers. And I think we're all, in our own way, pioneers. It's about the talents you have, it's about the skills you have and how you use them to make a difference, to make an impact on people's lives. Working with people, enabling them, empowering them, supporting them to get to where they, you know, can stand on their own two feet if that's what they need, or facilitating for them to, you know, contribute to society and make a difference. And I think for me, I don't know what my strength is as a pioneer, but one thing I believe in is I've always been a people person, wanting to work with people, and my background is in community development, and that's how I came into the Red Cross. Victor and myself were originally from Sierra Leone. We've gone through our own bit of turmoil quite some time back, and having to support family members back there while we were here was really a difficult time. But now, I think we're in the position where we're able to, you know, do our own bit of pioneering and working and supporting people who need that little bit of support and help. So my role in the Red Cross, and I've been with the Red Cross for 10 years, but I've worked in this field now for about over 20 years. I started off with a small refugee community organization in Reading, was with them for about 10 years before moving on to the Red Cross, but I've carried on within almost the same role as a senior services manager. And the way the Red Cross is Can you hear me? The way the Red Cross is structured, we work in areas, and I'll show you, you know, the bit we cover. It's mainly the Thames Valley. We work in Milton Keynes, in Reading, Oxfordshire. We have a base in Abingdon and with Buckinghamshire, trying to do some work in Highwycombe. And most of our work is based around where need is. I think there is need everywhere, but where there are gaps, we will step in and work in collaboration with others. So before I start, I just want to put some of the challenges, if you like, or our work with refugees in perspective, and I'll start with some numbers. The global displaced population, just under about 60 million, and a lot of these people, majority of them are internally displaced. And as you can see, where with the what we've just talked about, a lot of people are displaced